It's always a pleasure to have Frank Capel with us. He needs no introduction. He's been a staunch supporter of the rally for a long time. He's very helpful to all of us who are working in this field. He probably knows as much about more subjects than any of us here at the moment, except for Frank. And it is wonderful to have the editor of the Herald of Freedom taking part in our programs, and he is going to act as moderator this afternoon. So here is Frank Capel.
Fellow Americans, the communist takeover of most of the countries that they now occupy was made possible by the failure of the clergy to alert and warn the people in those countries of what was going to happen. Cuba, Czechoslovakia, and Chile, three countries, approximately 90% Christian, fell under communist control simply because the people were misled by their newspapers, magazines, and other forms of communication, and the clergy remained silent while the conspirators took over. In the communist countries, after they have taken over, things are entirely different. For example, I have talked with people who have lived in these countries, and on a more recent basis, they confirm the fact that all of the Christian clergymen who attempt to follow their religious doctrines as they did before are either under house arrest, in prison, or in concentration camps. Those that are allowed to function operate under the directives of the commissar of cults or his equivalent. In Red China, those priests and ministers who stood up for Christ wound up either being expelled, put into prison, tortured, suffered, and we know of many of them, Bishop O'Gara, Bishop Curry's, many of the others, Bishop Walsh. Those who cooperated were called the patriotic priests. They were allowed to function. They consecrated 40 bishops illicitly from among these so-called patriotic priests. Now, with a new cultural revolution in China, they have decided that they can't even stand a small amount of religion, and they are now killing the patriotic priests who have cooperated with them. Now, many of you may feel that this sort of thing can't happen here, but I say to you, there is a sudden silence on the part of our clergy here. We have many who are cooperating with the enemy, many who are knowingly or inadvertently promoting their programs. How long is it since you have heard important members of the Christian hierarchy condemning communism? How often in the religious articles and magazines do you find them warning the people about what is happening in our country? They are silent. And this is precisely what happened in the communist countries before they were taken over. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you will find signs of this if you will look around. You're no longer permitted to say prayers in schools. In the colleges, God is denied, God is dead. But the religion of atheism can be promoted and is promoted, and young people go to college as religious youngsters from their homes, and they come back denying the existence of God. Now, not all clergymen are doing this. There are some who are fighting the enemy, and by the grace of God, maybe perhaps more will do so, because unless they do, we may find ourselves in the position that these other unfortunate countries now find themselves in. It was the clergy who should have guided them, who should have spoken out against communism, who should have taught them in the churches and the schools. They didn't do so. They are now operating in a police state. We have, by the grace of God, a clergyman with us today who is out warning people, telling the truth about the conspiracy, about the enemies of our country. He has traveled all over this country. Now, our speaker studied for the priesthood at St. Thomas Seminary in the Catholic University, has a master's degree in philosophy. He has a degree in theology which gives him the right to teach the subject. He is a member of the Council of the John Birch Society, nationally known lecturer, and I may say that he is a personal friend of many years standing. I've had the honor year after year to introduce him. Ladies and gentlemen, he has traveled around this country. He has met opposition, I am sorry to say, from members of our own faith. He and I are both Roman Catholics. We have been devoting our lives to fighting the enemy. He does not always get the cooperation which he ought to have as a priest in good standing, which he is, fighting for God and country. Ladies and gentlemen, the subject will be, "We Will Win If We Are Worthy." It is my honor and privilege to introduce to you Father Francis Fenton. And thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Colonel Bunker, Reverend Reed, representatives from Daniel Payne College, Reverend clergy, ladies and gentlemen. I feel I would be somewhat remiss in my duty if I did not take this occasion to offer my personal commendation to Mrs. McKinney, Colonel Bunker, and all of their dedicated, hardworking associates for the untold amount of time and effort they have expended in their preparation and direction of this 9th annual rally for God, family, and country, and to thank them for giving all of us this opportunity as American patriots to come together once again to manifest our allegiance and to pledge our loyalty to God, family, and country on these historic days which commemorate the anniversary of our nation's independence. This is the sixth consecutive year in which I have been invited to speak at this rally. While I am certainly grateful for the compliment to me which this implies, yet frankly, you are a difficult audience to address 6 years in a row. Difficult, certainly not in the sense of being unsympathetic, perish the thought, but rather in that so many of you are already so well informed. What can I tell most of you that you don't already know? It always reminds me somewhat of trying to save the saved. What can I say? Well, I do always manage to come up with something to say, and I do hope that the talk I am about to deliver will make some worthwhile contribution toward the ultimate attainment of the noble objectives we are all trying so hard to achieve. If we be worthy, wars, battles, strife, conflict of all kinds and of every description, they come and they go. For whatever reason or combination of reasons, they begin, and sooner or later, they end. Only one is perennial. From the very beginning of human history until this present moment, it has been in the world, and so it will be until the world itself is no more. I speak, of course, of the never-ending war, the everlasting conflict of good and evil, of moral right and moral wrong, of virtue and righteousness against vice and wickedness. But has there ever been, I wonder, a time when evil has more widely prevailed than in our day? It would seem not. Indeed, if ever there was a period in history when the powers of darkness appeared to be headed for a decisive triumph, that time is now. Immorality is widespread, vice and wickedness are rampant, all forms of evil abound. Oh, true enough, statements of this kind have been made to describe and to decry conditions of moral degradation in times past. But surely the depths of degeneracy to which America has sunk in recent years are without parallel. A condition bemoaned and deplored by all, who still retain any sense of morality and decency. Indeed, so extensive and so intensive is the immorality which today permeates and contaminates our land, and so grave is the threat posed by the continuing advance of the amoral communist conspiracy on the American scene, that some there are who are quite convinced that we are today in the last days foretold in the pages of Holy Scripture. Others there are who simply but firmly believe that the present situation is hopeless and that only prayer can save America from destruction. That, in other words, without some miraculous intervention of the Almighty, we are indeed doomed. But there is a third group of Americans who, while being well aware of the twin dangers of collectivism and immorality, which ever increasingly threaten the very survival of our country, who nonetheless remain optimistic about the ultimate outcome of the conflict which engages them, who are adamant in their refusal to be otherwise, and who are fully determined to make their optimistic expectations a reality in due time. I'm one of those. Are we being realistic? I believe we are. I believe that victory, even at this late date, is entirely within the realm of realism if we can get in time enough of our fellow Americans to join and to work with us, and if we be worthy. If we be worthy, that's a big if, whose realization or non-realization could well spell the difference for us at some future date between victory and defeat, the difference between the salvation of our country and its destruction through moral decay and communist subversion and conquest. If we be worthy, what constitutes our being worthy? What in the present context are the ingredients for worthiness? What would I consider to be at least some of the principal qualities, or if you will, virtues, which for our purposes would in their totality establish our worthiness, God willing? While it is safe to say that none of us fully possesses any of these qualities I will discuss, yet all of us must diligently work toward that ideal if we would be worthy of attaining the immediate and long-range objectives toward which we aim and to the realization of which so many of us are now devoting so much of our lives. First and foremost, we must have faith in God, the supreme, eternal, infinite, perfect being who created the world, who guides and controls its destiny, and to whom we are accountable for our words and deeds and lives. And that faith must be a lively or a living faith, which is to say, it must not be a static, passive thing involving little or nothing more than an admission of God's existence, but rather it must be a vital and very real thing, a faith which intimately and deeply affects our daily lives, a faith by which we live and move and are, a dynamic faith whose influence permeates our being and motivates our actions. In such a faith, a prayer, of course, plays an essential role, because if God is the being we believe him to be, then it follows that we must worship him, thank him, seek his guidance, and so on. While I most certainly do not believe that we can accomplish these tasks before us through prayer alone, yet I do believe with equal certainty that we cannot accomplish them without prayer. In the words of Holy Scripture, unless the Lord build the house, they labor in vain who build it. And in the words of the poet, more things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of. Just as our nation was founded and its noble documents composed by men who believed in God and in the power of prayer, so also will our nation be saved by men and women who believe in like manner. The words often attributed to St. Augustine are as good a summary as I know of what ought to be our attitude in this matter. Pray as if everything depended upon God, and work as if everything depended upon yourself. 'Tis said that those who follow the devil work like the devil. God expects us, I submit, to work at least as hard on his side. The words of William Penn are surely no less true today than when he uttered them. Those people who are not governed by God will be ruled by tyrants. Another observation I would make on this subject of faith has to do with the various religions and creeds that are represented in our conservative anti-communist ranks. In my many years of membership in the John Birch Society, as I have noted on many occasions, one of the things that has much impressed me has been the respect and goodwill shown by its members toward their fellow members of other faiths. Despite the many and often deep differences among them in matters of religious creeds and practices, yet in that society, tens of thousands of people are joined and have worked together over the past 12 years toward their dedication, through their dedication to a common cause and common goals. A high tribute indeed, in my opinion, to Mr. Robert Welch. For me to imply that the situation is just about perfect in this respect in the John Birch Society, this would be something less than honest on my part, for it is not. But to my mind, at least, it is very remarkable. And this is as it should be. Religious prejudice or bigotry should have no place in the ranks of the truly conservative. No matter how sincere a person may be, no matter how deeply held are his religious beliefs, he is, I contend, he is completely out of order in attacking, deriding, downgrading what may well be the equally deeply held religious beliefs of his fellow man. Certainly we can discuss our creedal differences in a way which is entirely proper and even beneficial to one another. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about situations wherein one person belittles, ridicules, even bitterly assails another's faith or church. This is wrong, very wrong, and makes no contribution whatsoever to our cause. We need it about as much as we need that proverbial hole in the head. The godless conspiracy of communism and the scourge of massive immorality, these are our deadly enemies against which our united opposition is essential if we would attain to victory. Religious discord must not be allowed to jeopardize that victory. A second essential quality which ought to mark the true conservative is that of honor. An honorable person is a person of integrity, of principle, of character. A person who makes a genuine and sustained effort to live an upright and moral life, both privately and in his dealings with his fellow men. He is a person of honesty and sincerity, and as such, he disdains hypocrisy and refuses to compromise on anything which to him is a matter of principle. However noble the objectives he seeks, he will not do evil to attain them, being firmly committed to the rule of morality that the end does not justify the means. He is industrious and conscientious in the performance of his daily tasks, and he strives always to do unto others as he would have them do unto him. Concerned though he be for justice, however, he is ready to temper that stern quality with charity and kindness whenever possible. High on the list of qualities we must possess if we be worthy, Without honor, we most certainly would not be deserving to attain the goals we seek. It is a quality whose notable absence among so many of those in positions of leadership and influence in our national life is undoubtedly the prime cause why America today is in the mess it is. Just limiting my comments here to the area of government and politics, although a woeful lack of honor is all too evident in other fields as well, the increasingly grave crisis facing our nation at the present time is due above all else to the fact that men without honor are charting and guiding its course. That in the words of the Old Testament book of Psalms, in high place are the basest of men. The downhill direction of the United States over the past several decades is not, as every sincere informed person well knows, this is not the result of stupidity or mistakes or forces beyond our control, but rather it is the result of the duplicity and the disloyalty and the treason of those in key positions, so-called leaders. So-called leaders, some elected, some appointed, men and women, who are without principle, without character, without integrity, in a word, without honor. While I refer primarily to those at the top levels of government, yet so many of those of lower rank in the political arena are but to a degree less deserving of grave censure. We have an abundance of politicians. We have a pathetic lack of statesmen. It is then upon our political leadership, or rather what passes for it, that the brunt of the blame must be placed for the current sad and sorry state of the nation, both in domestic matters and in the conduct of foreign affairs. Other factors, to be sure, have played a sizable part in America's retreat from greatness. The communications media, the schools, the churches, and so on. But the present condition of our nation, I contend, would not be what it is today if we had political leaders of the right caliber and in sufficient numbers, able, courageous, and above all else, God-serving, honorable men. It is imperative that we get them in the time remaining to us. We won't, of course, unless and until enough of the American electorate become informed and dedicated enough to bring this about. It is our job, with education as our strategy and truth as our weapon, it is our job to produce such an electorate in the weeks and months ahead. But in all of our efforts to expose and to oppose the communist conspiracy and to counteract the gross and rampant immorality which presently infects and defiles our land, let us ourselves always proceed with honor. Yes, victory is our goal, but not at any price. We must never sacrifice principle. We must never employ immoral means to achieve our objectives. Far better to suffer defeat with honor than victory gained in dishonor. And then there is truth, a deep appreciation and ardent love of which must surely be considered as among the most essential qualities we must possess if we be worthy. While all virtues, all noble qualities may be called godly or godlike, and all have God as their ultimate author and source, yet truth is surely one of the most distinctive of all the divine attributes. God is the supreme personification of truth. In him is found the perfection of truth. Indeed, God is truth. It is hardly surprising, then, that communism, denying as it does the very existence of God, has absolutely no regard for truth, except insofar as it might happen to serve its satanic purposes to be truthful in a particular case. To the communist, whatever furthers his immediate or long-range goals is good and right and true. Whatever hinders or obstructs the attainment of those goals is bad and wrong and false. His spoken or written word means absolutely nothing. Promises are like pie crust, he says, made to be broken. But disregard for the truth is not the monopoly of the communist by any means. For falsehoods, half-truths, innuendos, distortions, these are the stock in trade of most of the American communications media. Surely one of the best allies the communist conspirators could possibly have in their efforts to destroy our nation. If the so-called American press had told the awful truth about communism to the American people over the past several decades, there is no doubt to my mind but that the communist conspiracy would never have become the momentous threat to this country which it now is. Nor do I have any doubt if that same so-called American press, even at this late date, if that press began to tell the truth to the American people, I have no doubt but that the communist conspiracy would be effectively exposed and ultimately defeated. The chances of this happening are very slim indeed. It goes without saying, of course, that our alleged political leaders, so many of them, have a similar regard for truth, that is, none whatsoever, unless on occasion to tell the truth happens to be to their political advantage. But whatever be the extent of the irreverence and contempt for truth on the part of those who do not share our principles or who are even hostile to them, let us ever be zealous in its pursuit, treasure its worth, and be unremitting in our efforts to convey it to all men of goodwill. Let us never compromise truth for whatever reason, nor underestimate its value, nor attempt to justify any abuse of it on the score that our enemies do so. Two wrongs never made a right. Truth is, I submit, the most effective single weapon we possess. And God willing, truth will one day prove to be the most decisive single factor involved in bringing about the victory we seek. And let there be no doubt of this, we do have the truth on our side. Aware of this, and confident that upon the sufficient propagation of that truth to our fellow Americans in the time at our disposal depends under God the success of our efforts, may the words of the Bible's book of Ecclesiasticus be our inspiration. Even to the death, fight for truth, and the Lord your God will battle for you. And then there is love. Of all the ideals that comprise moral excellence, of all noble qualities, of all virtues, the scripture tells us that the greatest of these is love. At a public meeting of conservative Catholics some time ago, one of the pre-speakers, a staunch and scholarly anti-communist man, in the course of his address, made this blunt and concise observation I'm sick of love. Needless to say, the liberal press coverage of his talk gave much prominence to that observation. We know what he meant. He was disgusted with what is being passed off as love by the entertainment and publishing media and by assorted do-gooders and by so many misguided young people. He was disgusted with these things. So am I. Lust, all kinds of sexual aberrations and perversions, unrestrained sensual gratification, all this isn't love, but rather it is the mutilation and the desecration of love. Indeed, it is this satanic and widespread deformation and contortion of true love, which is surely one of the prime causes, as well as one of the best examples, of the current state of moral decay in America. A moral decay contributing immeasurably to the destruction of our country from within. Nor is it any wonder, with the ideal of true love so mangled and in such disrepute among so many, is it any wonder that the murder of unborn and unwanted human beings is now legalized and practiced on a mass scale. 160,000 unborn babies were murdered in Lindsay's fun city of New York alone within the past year. 160,000. There is one abortion for every 5 live births in the state of Hawaii. Such is the morality of some of our phony brotherly lovers. The legalization of infanticide and euthanasia will surely follow unless the righteous indignation of enough conscientious Americans can be aroused in defense of that most basic of all civil and human rights, the right to life. But true love remains, despite all efforts to debase and to destroy it. Of the myriad forces of human motivation, it is the most powerful. Countless men and women throughout history have willingly made the supreme sacrifice of their lives for the object of their love and in testimony to it. Through its inspiration, no sacrifice is too great to make, no hardship too difficult to endure. And so it will ever be. And if we be worthy, the true love of which I speak, that love which the Bible and spiritual writers and poets have so eloquently described and proclaimed, and which has been so heroically demonstrated in the lives and deaths of saints and patriots all down through the ages, that is the kind of love, if we be worthy, which must have a place in our hearts and souls and manifest itself in the words and deeds of our daily lives. And so it does. The faltering and inadequate, though our expression of it may be at times. Indeed, is not love the one virtue, the one force above all others, which motivates us fervently to pursue the goals we seek and to remain adamant in our determination to reach them? If our prime motivating force isn't love, what is? May this love of which I speak be strong enough in each of us to exclude from our hearts all hatred of our fellow men. Just as we must hate sin while loving the sinner, so also, while hating the evil of communism and incessantly opposing it to the very utmost in every morally lawful way at our disposal, we must nonetheless love even the communist. For the words of Christ, Because the words of Christ, love your enemies. These words leave no room for doubt. May this love and the courage and dedication and fortitude and discipline which it inspires, may this love endure and increase in all of us with each passing day. And then there is hope, by which I mean that virtue, that quality, which inspires and urges us to look forward with confidence toward the fulfillment of our labors and aspirations in God's own good time. Since this word hope is often used in the sense of a vague longing for some impossible dream, I am not, needless to say, I am not employing it in that sense. The hope to which I refer is not a pie-in-the-sky thing, but rather it is a firm expectation that despite all the setbacks we have experienced, despite all the obstacles which face us, we can attain the objectives we seek, and that if we be worthy, we will attain them. Let neither the magnitude of our undertaking nor the firm entrenchment in positions of power and influence of the forces of evil cause us to falter or despair. And let discouragement find no entry into our minds and hearts. Because whatever else may be in our favor, without a strong and unwavering will to win, the ultimate victory for which we strive will not be forthcoming. I, for one, have always been hopeful and optimistic of the successful outcome of the fight which engages us. It would be a colossal tragedy indeed were we to lose because too many on our side did not have the will to win. Such then, with a commentary in each of them, are at least some of the principal qualities which I feel must comprise the spiritual armor of the true conservative and authentic patriot. The list I have given is hardly an exhaustive one. Other qualities, perhaps of equal importance, might be added. But, hopefully, the point is clear, that if we be worthy of victory over the satanic enemy we face, we must be men and women whose religious beliefs and spiritual values and moral principles and humane ideals are diametrically opposed to the unmitigated evil represented by and embodied in that satanic enemy. If, as I have often said on other occasions, if the communist conspiracy is not diabolical in the literal sense of the term, it is certainly the closest thing to it that has thus far appeared upon the world scene. Incessantly, to expose and to oppose it in every legitimate way, with all of the resources at his command, this is the bounden duty of each and every American who cherishes in his heart a love of freedom and who ardently desires to preserve that freedom for himself and for his fellow Americans and to help in restoring it to those millions of his fellow men now subjugated to communist slavery around the world. Some months ago, the Review of the News magazine, in its issue of February 24th, 1971, the Review of the News magazine gave a quotation displayed at the headquarters of a courageous anti-communist of the Mao people in Laos, Major General Vang Pao, a quotation which impressed me very much. It read, "To be born a free man is an accident, to live one a responsibility, to die one an obligation." Again, to be born a free man is an accident, to live one a responsibility, to die one an obligation. A paraphrase of that quotation today might be, "It is better to be dead than red." It is better to die in a noble effort to defend freedom than to live in slavery. The motto of the state of New Hampshire says it very concisely: live free or die. The communist conspirators and the insiders who control them are hell-bent on enslaving or burying what's left of the free world, with the conquest of America their prize objective. If America succumbs, barring a miracle, if America succumbs, freedom will surely perish for all mankind. To surrender to communism is unthinkable. To coexist with communism is impossible. To fight it staunchly and perseveringly, this is the only honorable alternative we have. But to do so effectively and to be deserving of victory, it is imperative that we ourselves be a godly people, men and women of faith and honor and truth and courage and fortitude and hope and all the rest. Otherwise, I submit, we are not worthy of victory. And if we don't do the job, who else, I ask, is going to do it? Surely not those alleged leaders, so many of them, of the type we have had for the last several decades and continue to have. The communist conspiracy is the world power it is today and constitutes the increasingly grave menace it does to America, primarily because so many of those in key positions of power and influence in the American government either have been and are knowingly and willingly on the side of the enemy, or because they have been and are cowardly, dishonorable, opportunistic politicians who would rather despicably collaborate with the enemy and allow our nation to be destroyed from within than stand up for God and country, as did the heroic American statesmen of the past who contributed so much to make America the great nation it once was. But if we don't do the job, may we look perhaps to the communications media to do it? Hardly, because it is the controlled press of America that is mainly responsible for the widespread ignorance and apathy that continue to prevail among so many of our fellow citizens regarding communism and its allied evils. Nor is there any reason to suppose that that press is likely to turn American in the foreseeable future and start identifying and telling the truth about our nation's enemies. How appropriately may the words of Isaiah the prophet be applied to the kept press of America: woe to those who call evil good and good evil. But if we don't do the job, might we look to the churches to do it? In my opinion, if we do, we look in vain. Similar to my previous observation regarding the American press, had the churches of America, despite the government and the press, had the churches of America taken a forthright stand in opposition to communism over the past years and maintained that stand, the communist conspiracy, I submit, would not here and now pose the dire threat it does to our nation and to all that we hold dear. Had the Catholic Church in America held fast to the strong position against communism it once had, and which was so strikingly presented in the great encyclical on atheistic communism of Pope Pius XI, the communist plan to take over America would never have reached the stage of implementation it presently occupies. However, this is what might have been. The very sad and sorry fact is that the churches of America, with but few exceptions, are not only not fighting communism, but through so many of their personnel and publications and organizations and educational institutions, most of the churches of America are supporting and promoting the communist conspiracy. The ever-increasing collaboration of the Catholic Church in America with the notorious leftist un-American National Council of Churches, this is but one of scores of examples of the current deplorable state of affairs in most of our nation's churches. The communist conspirators, knowing full well that they could not conquer a country whose churches were spiritually and morally strong, and whose members, in addition to being informed and dedicated citizens, were a truly godly people, the communist conspirators set out years ago to infiltrate and to subvert the churches. To give the devil his due, they have done their work very well indeed. And nowhere is this more evident to me as a Catholic priest than in the Catholic Church. No, we cannot look to the churches of America to do the job, and anyone today is woefully uninformed or very naive who sincerely thinks otherwise. And so I repeat, if we, the conservative, informed, God-serving, patriotic, anti-communist citizens of America, if we don't do the job, who else is going to do it? The answer is simple and clear. Nobody's going to do it. It just isn't going to be done. And if it isn't, this land of ours will fall to communist conquest with a nightmare of cruelty and barbarity and ruthlessness following that conquest on a scale and to a degree which all but defies adequate description. But thank God, this does not have to be. It is not inevitable. And despite the federal government, despite the press, despite the churches, despite the schools, please God, it will not be. In the words of Mr. Robert Welsh, written some 4 months ago in a letter to the chapter leaders of the John Birch Society around the country, quote, "We are visibly in the most critical period of the final and crucial battle to save our freedom and our lives," unquote. Again, we are visibly in the most critical period of the final and crucial battle to save our freedom and our lives. That the challenge confronting us is an awesome one, there is no question. That we are approaching a decisive crisis, there is no doubt. Nor is there any question nor doubt in my mind that with a sufficient increase in our numbers in time, we can and we will successfully meet that challenge and survive that crisis if we be worthy. Let us strive as never before to increase our ranks with the caliber of American we seek, and let us, each and every one, let us redouble our efforts in every way in the days and weeks and months ahead in the fight for God, family, and country in which we are engaged. We can and we will win if we be worthy. The question is not, is God on our side? God is diametrically opposed to all that is evil, and communism is consummate evil. But rather the question is, are we on God's side? O Lord, make us worthy. O God, help us to be worthy. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the charity of your prayers, pray for the misguided people who are the enemies of our country, that God will give them an opportunity to straighten out before it is too late, because they don't know it, that they too are expendable. The communist will never, in the final stages, trust those who have been traitors to their own country. Also, in your prayers, please pray for Father Fenton and the other dedicated priests and ministers who are trying to serve our country. Thank you.